Hi, everybody, and welcome back to the Personal Democracy Forum's regular series of conference calls for members of the PDF Network, which, by the way, is going to be called Personal Democracy Plus. And as always, we have to thank our sponsor, AT&T, for making these calls possible. This week, we will be joined by Gigi Sohn, who is the president and founder of Public Knowledge, which is a small but very hardworking nonprofit organization in Washington that works on issues related to, internet and the public interest. And we're going to really get into the details with her of what it's like to battle on a daily basis inside Washington for user rights, for online democracy, for the sort of freedom of choice and the best possible services that consumers ought to be able to get against a system that is in many cases dominated by some very big and well-heeled players. Just to say before we dive in, that, as always, this conversation is going to be structured like our previous calls. For the first half hour, it'll be me and Gigi talking, and then in the second half hour, we will open up the call to people who are listening in, who want to ask a question. In addition, if you are listening and want to tweet along, use either PDF Network or PD Plus. We want to start switching over to PD Plus, but some people may still be using PDF Network to tweet about the call. And if I see a question there that someone is raising or a comment, I'll try and inject that into the conversation. So without any further ado, Gigi, thank you for joining us. Before we dive into the nitty-gritty, I wonder if you would just say a little bit, to set the stage. What is Public Knowledge? How long has it been around? And what do you guys focus on? And who supports you in your work? Give us the sort of the lay of the land from where you sit.
Sure. Thanks, Mika. And thanks to everybody for being on the call. It's really a privilege for me to be on the call and talk a little bit about Public Knowledge and the work we do. So Public Knowledge is just turned 10 years old this year, which I'm very proud of. I am one of the co-founders, and I am the president. And we represent the public's right to an open, democratic, decentralized communication system. And that means we work in several areas. We work on broadband policy and trying to ensure an open internet, an internet without gatekeepers. We try to ensure that consumers can attach any device to the network. As long as it's not harmful to the network, we think you should be able to use any phone on any network or any set-top box on any cable network. We also do a lot of work in the copyright space because to us, just like Comcast and AT&T and Verizon are the network gatekeepers that could determine whether the internet is an open democratic medium, the Hollywood studios and the big recording companies also serve as gatekeepers, using copyright as a cudgel to prevent the free flow of information and free speech. So those are the two big areas we work in, and that means we do advocacy at the Federal Communications Commission, the Federal Trade Commission, the Copyright Office. Obviously, we lobby on Capitol Hill. We work with the executive branch a lot. We'd love to do more privacy and more patent work, but right now it's not in the cards for us. So we really focus on those two areas, so telecommunications policy and copyright and some trademark policy. Again, all in the service of ensuring an open communication system where you and I have control over our communications as opposed to some huge multinational company.
And the primary support for you comes from foundations?
Yes, we are primarily funded by foundations. I worked at the Ford Foundation for a number of years. I actually developed the portfolio that is now our biggest funder. We also received over the years funding from the Open Society Institute, Cummings Foundation, Warhol Foundation, Rockefeller Foundation. Mm-hmm. They've come in and out. They don't all fund us now. We also take funding from individuals, and we take corporate funding as well in small amounts, but from all parts of the industry. So this might shock people. Even though we agree with Comcast on just about nothing, they give us a small contribution every year. So we do take, it's a small part of our budget. Unfortunately, foundation funding is not enough to allow us to be effective. I wish it was, but it isn't. So we do take money from individuals, law firms, and some, and like I said, most companies that are in this space.
And I have to say, just looking at your annual report, you have a very impressive group of directors, including people like Susan Crawford, who is a good friend of ours, Joy Ito, who's now the chair at the MIT Media Lab, Reed Hunt, a former FCC chairman, Brewster Kahle from the Internet Archive. It's many people who are working hard in different ways to realize the benefits of a truly open and robust Internet. And just to be clear, your work is, you know, I mean, everybody has to specialize somewhere. So you're specialize in the kind of detailed policy knowledge and lobbying that needs to be done inside Washington on a daily basis. Would that be
That's
fair?
That's correct. I mean, we're more inside Washington than outside. Now, on this copyright bill, this awful copyright bill, which I'm happy to, which I hope we'll talk about.
We'll get right into it.
Definitely working the grassroots. But we're also we also join with groups like Demand Progress. I'm happy to say that our colleagues at Free Press are working this bill. They generally haven't done copyright related work, but this bill is really is not about copyright. It's about whether the Internet is going to be open or whether it's going to be completely restructured to protect copyright. So we're working with them. We work with EFF. So we work working in coalition is critical to us. And and not only working collaboratively with our friends who work both on, you know, telecommunications and media policy and also on copyright policy, but also working with companies who have commonality of interest. So obviously when we talk about things like network neutrality or AT&T Mobile, we are going to be at odds with the telephone companies and cable companies. But when it comes to copyright policy, and when Hollywood and the recording industry wants to, you know, shift the liability for copyright enforcement onto not only Google and Yahoo and Facebook, but also onto the Internet access providers like Comcast and Verizon and AT&T, we actually find commonality of cause. So we have shifting alliances. The fact of the matter is, yeah, it makes sense, right?
So let's dive in on the, I mean, the this new Stop Online Privacy Act, SOPA. Which is, as I understand it, it's kind of the House version of the Protect IP Act, which has already gotten through the Senate, but it's in some ways worse. So, you know, give us the first the roundup of, you know, why you're so concerned about this, and then I really, you know, do want to, you know, get into the nitty-gritty of what it's like to kind of fight these battles on a daily basis. What are you up against?
So let me just say a little bit about Protect IP and SOPA. So I'll call it PIPA and SOPA if that works for people. So PIPA has not yet passed the Senate. Thanks to our hero and, frankly, America's hero, Ron Wyden, who has placed a hold on this bill essentially since it's been introduced, PIPA has passed through the Judiciary Committee, so the Judiciary Committee has not gone to the floor.
That's my error then.
Yeah, my folks just met with Senator Reid's staffer who said they're going to try to get it on the floor. They're going to try to roll Senator Wyden. And rest assured that folks will start getting action alerts from us and our sister organizations when we get a sense of when that's going to happen. So we'll definitely let people know, but that's a threat. So it's not yet been passed through the Senate. The House is going to have a hearing on November 16th, and they also want to push through their version of the bill. So how is their version of the bill worse than the Senate version of the bill? Well, basically, it lowers the standard by which any Internet intermediary, and again, by when I say Internet intermediary, I mean search engines, you know, domain name system registrars and registers, internet access providers, anybody who provides any kind of conduit for internet conduct and internet content,
mm-hmm.
will basically be held liable if their website, if their conduit is used for any kind of copyright infringement. So it
mm-hmm.
basically puts every single link in the internet chain at risk of getting an order from the Attorney General making it, you know, block websites that they believe are infringing a copyright.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just, it's remarkable. The way it's been for the past, you know, past 25 years of the internet is that if there's copyright infringing content online, the content holder, the Hollywood studio, the record company, has to tell Google, has to tell Verizon, you take down that content. And if they take it down, there's no liability. This completely
mm-hmm.
changes the equation. This puts
mm-hmm.
the onus on Google, on Verizon, on Comcast, on Yahoo, on Facebook to be the copyright police at the behest of the Department of Justice. And I think that is very, very dangerous for the free flow of information.
And is this, I mean, at the technical level, is there some other, there's some of the elements here just have to do with putting the burden on the site owner themselves to police their own site in ways that many, many smaller startups or independent, you know, website operators would just find incredibly onerous. Isn't that part of the problem, too?
That's absolutely the case. Because it lowers the standard for, you know, how you can hold a website, a site owner liable, you basically have to guess. And it is a guess, right? Because it's not so clear about what is a copyright violation and what is what we call a fair use. So fair
right.
use for folks that are not familiar with copyright is an exception to the rights that copyright holders have. And an example of fair use is when you parody somebody.
Mm-hmm.
It also
mm-hmm.
depends on how much of the original work you use and how you use it. So it's something that a judge usually has to determine whether it's a fair use or not. So now you're placing
mm-hmm.
the burden of a site owner. They could be selling chocolate, right? Or they
right.
could be, you know, they could be doing any number of things. It could be a music blog. All of a sudden, they have to determine whether something is a fair use. That is a very, very unfair and unreasonable burden to place on them.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But what's the, I mean, like, what's the most damaging effect you could see in terms of the, you know, what are the penalties that they're proposing to impose here for somebody who, you know, doesn't, you know, so I post a video on my site of, you know, my kid sister singing her favorite, you know, Justin Bieber song, right?
Right.
And then the, you know, the company that owns the rights to that song goes after me. Where, you know, let's bring it down to the level where, you know, the ordinary person can kind of go, oh,
right.
Why is
so
this?
Yeah. here's the level: is your website is taken down. It's basically removed, okay, and nobody can
uh-huh.
find it.
Uh-huh,
all right,
uh-huh.
And then you have to struggle, and actually, by the way, the government's already doing this in some instances. They're basically blocking access to websites, okay, and basically taking their domain names away from them.
Right.
And then you have to fight like the Dickens to get your domain name back. So if your identity or your brand is tied up in your domain name, you are out of luck.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and this is based on allegation.
Right.
Okay, and I will say this is one, I've been doing this for 10 years, this is one of a long line of crazy ideas that the studios have for controlling their content.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the previous idea was, you know, if you are alleged to have infringed copyright 3 times on peer-to-peer, they cut off your internet connection. That's called 3 strikes, you're out.
Right.
This is based on allegations. We're a country of laws that says you are innocent until proven guilty. This is
right.
guilty
right.
until proven innocent.
Right.
And then there are also
right.
other technical this will destabilize the internet. I don't really want to get into all the details of when you go after, you know, domain name registers and registrars, you know, how it just
mm-hmm.
destabilizes the entire internet and makes it
mm-hmm.
easier for not only companies to control, but for governments to control. And it makes the Internet less secure. I mean, we can get into that if we want, but the bottom line is the threat to you is that you could be served with an order from the Attorney General and your domain name, your domain will be blocked and your domain name will be taken away from you. It's great. GoDaddy loves it. GoDaddy supports it. You know why? Because every time you lose your domain name, you have to buy another one from them.
Right. And there's no due process here. It's after the fact.
Yeah, the due process.
To get it back.
Like I said, there are the of all people, the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Service has been already starting to block these domain names. And they've basically been making it, several people have wanted to challenge it. Like there's this sports website in Spain called Roja Directa, which is legal in Spain, by the way. And their lawyer has been trying to get the information necessary to go to court, and they've been making it difficult. So there's no built-in due process protections.
Yeah. So what's the, okay, so this, where did this bill come from? You know, who's pushing it? And then how do you, you know, but the idea we were going to get to here is, okay, so you've identified the problem, right?
Right.
There's yet another bad bill floating around out there.
Right.
So what do you, what does public knowledge try to do in this?
Well, let me tell you what we're up against, okay?
Right. Okay.
And, you know, I've been doing this kind of work for over 20 years, so obviously, you know, I think we make progress. It's not all, you know, I may sound like all gloom and doom, but actually given, you know, the amount of money that's in this entire sort of media technology policy reform field, it's tiny, we've actually made some progress. So generally, overall, I'm a pretty optimistic person. Let me just tell you what we're up against. The Hollywood studios and the recording industry, even though they don't actually contribute all that much to our economy or that GDP, or certainly not compared to the tech sector, they have just inordinate amount of power in Washington, and that's because they've been around for 100 years.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and all the studios own broadcast stations, and some of them now own cable systems, so they are used to being in Washington as regulated entities. So they not only do the usual things that corporations do, that is, give tons of money to both parties. It used to be that Hollywood and the recording industry were very much identified with Democrats. That has changed in the last 5-6 years, largely due to the fact that the Recording Industry Association of America, RIAA, hired Bill Frist's chief of staff, a guy named Mitch Bainwall, who made it specifically his business to court Republicans. So now you have both Democrats and Republicans that feel beholden to Hollywood. Hollywood's spreading their money around, but they do more than that, okay? On 16th and I Street, they have a huge screening room where they show first-run movies and invite legislators and policymakers to come. We could never match that. They not only spread around their own money, they go to public knowledges and other groups like EFF's funders, our foundation funders. I know this for a fact, that several of the studios have gone to the funders and said, why are you funding these people? They're dangerous. It's remarkable to me that they even have the time to do that. And this, you know, this is the kind of things they do. They still have lavish parties, even in these tough times. They have huge fundraisers for senators and Congress members and the president. The president was just out in Hollywood not that long ago. But that's what we're up against. So how do we fight that? Well, we fight that, number one, just through persistent advocacy. You know, we don't have nearly as many lobbyists as they do, but we do have our friends on the Hill, and we try to leverage them to get more friends in Congress. And we also leverage the grassroots. So, you know, we do a combination of, you know, action alerts, in-district visits, in-Washington visits, and then the public debate, which I think is critically important. You know, we can rely on people like Cory Doctorow, Om Malik, Matt Lazar, and Nate Anderson of Ars Technica, to continue to beat the drum and shape the public perception. And I think we're pretty good in the press, too. It's interesting. The Los Angeles Times, which is Hollywood's hometown newspaper, has consistently been on our side on the SOPA and TIPA bills. So we have a multi-pronged approach. It's not just trying, because we can't match them one for one on Capitol Hill. So we've got to go out to the public. We've got to go out to the press. We've got to go out to the blogosphere. And we really have to sort of change the public perception that this is not just, they would like you to believe that this is just a bill that protects their IP against these horrible rogue websites. Mm-hmm. Our position is no. This is a bill that will fundamentally change the Internet and give these huge multinational media companies control over it.
Do you think that the last few years where Congress, members of Congress and their staff themselves are finally, you know, becoming more digitally literate in the sense that, you know, many of them are using these tools, many of them are using these sites, you know, they finally got, you know, through the sort of lawyers' objections and their own sort of traditional objections to using social media. And we certainly hear a lot about how, you know, much members of Congress are tweeting or on YouTube. So do you think that's perhaps helping shift their understanding of how the Internet works, why, you know, we have to fight to keep it open, or it doesn't penetrate? I mean, do you see any sign, you know, because we certainly at PDF have, you know, our eyes out for members and staffers on both sides of the aisle who seem to get it, who, you know, are, whether they harness online social networks in smart ways to help themselves get, you know, elected or to move their messages. And, you know, there's a certain element of this that's more two-way, you know, it's different than broadcast media. So do you think there's any sign of, you know, the culture shifting inside the institution just because they're using the tools?
Yes, but it's very, very slow, and it's much slower than we would like. You know, because while the staffer may be 23 or 25 and using Twitter, the member, and this is particularly true of the Senate, is probably 85.
I know, yeah.
You know, so, you know, you still have the member. You know, you have an influx of more technologically savvy members, and this is particularly true on the Republican side. As well as the Democratic side, but you still have folks who they don't do their own tweeting, and you know they barely use a computer. So it is slowly changing atmosphere there. But let me explain something else. I think it's really important. It generally comes up on the copyright space. Is that people seem to have cordoned off copyright. I think Cory Doctorow actually just wrote something about this today. From the rest of the debate over the open Internet. I mean, it's even hard, you know, Public Knowledge is the only organization in Washington, D.C. right now doing day-to-day work, you know, public interest advocacy organization doing day-to-day work on copyright. Okay, because people say, oh, that's something else, right? And Hollywood portrays it as, you know, it's about enforcing our, you know, right to our property. But when you force Google and force more websites holders and force Internet access providers to become the copyright police, you are fundamentally changing the nature of the Internet and the end-to-end nature of the Internet and the open nature of the Internet. And that people have not made that connection yet. They think they can sort of cordon off copyright and intellectual property enforcement from the health and growth of the Internet generally. And until we can get people to understand that they are married together, that they are integral to one another, it's going to be a little bit harder to make progress. But, yes, so things are changing very slowly. But I think Corey's article was don't call it copyright anymore. It's not about copyright. It's about an open Internet. It's about, you know, the free flow of information. And let's get away from those silos that people like to put that in. It doesn't help us. It helps the other side for sure.
So, you know, on a daily basis, you know, what does this come down to for you? I mean, what does your day look like in terms of
my day is I have an ADD job. I mean, number one, no 2 days are alike, and, you know, I could be literally working on 6 or 7 things at one time. I think a good way to describe what my day might look like is to talk a little bit about, if you don't mind me shifting gears just a little bit, on the AT&T T-Mobile takeover.
Yeah, wanted to get into that, too. That's another very important continuing saga.
Right, and again, at the risk of you know, boring people that are more deeply steeped in these issues, AT&T in March proposed to take over T-Mobile, which would combine the second-largest wireless telephone company, the fourth-largest wireless telephone company. And if that deal were to be consummated, AT&T and Verizon would control 80% of the wireless telephone and wireless Internet access market, which is double of what the concentration you would see of the number one and number two in any other market. If you look at gas, auto, airline, it would be double that amount. So it's just unprecedented, and I think a sign of, you know, AT&T's hubris and AT&T's guts, let's put it that way, to even try to push this through. And in August, the Department of Justice decided to block the merger, and now that is a court case, actually. They actually have to go to court to block the merger, and that case is pending. We're waiting for the Federal Communications Commission to act. If they act to block this merger, it's over, essentially, for all intents and purposes. But as some of you may know, you know, this chairman, this FCC chairman, is very deliberate. He doesn't always, you know, have the courage to engage in these kind of so-called controversial acts, although it's not that controversial when the Department of Justice already blocked it. So we're trying to push him to act before the court case is heard and the court case is decided, because even though we believe that the Justice Department has a very strong case and they've been winning every step of the way, the Justice Department has, and in fact, just this week, the judge decided that Sprint and CSpire, which is both competitive companies to AT&T, that their court cases could move forward, which is not only significant, it's something we didn't expect. There also came another decision came out of the same court blocking a 3-2 merger, which is exactly what this is, you know, pretty well, it's a 4-3 merger. So all the cards are stacked against AT&T, so we think we're going to win in court, but despite that fact, you never know what's going to happen in court. You never know how a judge is going to act. So for the FCC to act now would essentially put the final nail in the coffin of this very, very bad takeover. So what is my day like working on this merger? Well, I have to, you know, in addition to speaking both with the Justice Department and with the FCC and, you know, trying to help them make their case to block this deal, I mean, that's a common issue advocacy that we have to deal with. We often get attacked by the right-wing press, folks like, you know, Red State and Less Government. So we're constantly dealing with attacks fully funded by AT&T. It's like not even a secret, calling us, you know, Soros-supported Marxists and Google shills and all these kind of – so, I mean, I don't often respond to those things, but those are things, again, they shape the debate. They, you know, they're out in the air. We have to contend with the fact that AT&T has funded untold numbers of not just national organizations. It's been pretty well documented about how they've given large amounts of money to a number of the national civil rights organizations, and there was a huge blowback when one of the gay rights organizations actually reversed its position because they got so much static. This was the Gay and Lesbian Alliance Against Defamation. So we often, you know, have to deal with, you know, how do you combat the perception that civil rights groups and all these other local groups, like AT&T gave money to the Louisiana Balloon Foundation, the International Rights Festival, the Montana Cattle Ranchers Association, and they all filed comments at the FCC in favor of this merger. So how do you deal with, you know, the hordes of the, you know, it's funny, I have my Google alert set on AT&T, and every day I see, oh, they gave the Girl Scouts this money, and they gave, you know, the 4-H that money, and I keep waiting for the filings at the FCC from the Girl Scouts and the 4-H supporting the merger. Have to deal with the ads. I mean, they have, AT&T spends, it's documented that they spend $5 million a quarter in lobbying. But that's just congressional lobbying.
Mm-hmm.
Right? That doesn't count what they're doing at the state legislatures. They've had a large, I think half of the governors in the country write in to Congress and tell them, consider the Justice Department, and the FCC and tell them to let this deal go through. They have a bunch of state attorneys general do it. So it is a constant game of pinball trying to figure, you know, where can we have sort of the most bang for our more limited buck.
Right.
So what we try to do is every time they try to spin a new meme, for example, the meme for a while has been this merger will create 96,000 jobs. So we have basically, you know, gotten proof that there's no way. And in fact, this merger will lead to fewer jobs.
Mm-hmm.
So we do things like post blog posts, not only on our own blog, but also on Huffington Post. We talk to the press. Art Brodsky is my communications director, who's listening in here. He basically dredges up, you know, gets our friends in the press to write stories, you know, trying to raise skepticism about whether this would create jobs. Another meme that AT&T floated was justice wants to settle. And we knocked that one down. It seems like every other week there's just a new meme
Yeah. Right. But is the audience the press? Is the audience congressional staffers? I mean, who are you really trying to influence here in this conversation? You know, and you said before, you know, you're trying to pressure the FCC, you know, to take a position on this. So, you know, walk us through, what do you actually do? I mean, you're not beaming thought waves at Julius Genachowski.
Right. Right.
You know, no one's perfected that technology yet. So what's the how do you actually get into these people's awareness in a way that you know can make a difference?
So obviously we do the shoe leather, right? So,
mm-hmm.
you know, I and my staff are constantly meeting with FCC staff, with the commissioners, with the what they call the transaction team, which is a group of experts working on the transaction, with the chairman
mm-hmm.
when he'll see people. He's not a very available guy, but we can get in to see him when we want. So there is direct oral advocacy. There's direct written advocacy. You know, we filed, you know, the FCC when opened a proceeding to consider this merger. And we obviously filed what we call a petition to deny the merger, basically asking the FCC to block it. So we do both written advocacy, oral advocacy. We do directed press work, you know, just talking to the press, not only through blanket press releases, but through individual calls of the most influential bloggers and the most influential press. I do probably 40 or so speaking engagements a year. And this
mm-hmm.
year, there's been an awful lot on AT&T and T-Mobile, and there'll be everything from a conference at a law school to briefings on the Hill, you know, among a lot of staffers. We really spread it far and wide, and then we have
mm-hmm.
a strong Facebook and Twitter presence. I spend a half
mm-hmm.
an hour at least every day tweeting, you know, critical court cases, critical articles. And the idea is to try to build, not only build awareness, but build our own meme that this takeover is bad for consumers, bad for competition, and is on the rocks. And that's a big thing, because AT&T has tried to paint this as having an air of inevitability.
Mm-hmm.
And now they've had
mm-hmm.
so many losses, the Justice Department and court, we're now saying this is a loser, and they're just throwing good money after bad. And they really just should, they just should quit. They just should, you know, say, we don't want to do this anymore.
Yeah, yeah. We've just reached a little past the halfway point, so I just want to let folks know if anybody listening has a question that they'd like to ask Gigi Sohn, what you should do is hit *6 on your phone, we'll make room for you to ask your question, though if no one does, I'll keep the conversation going myself. I'm always full of questions. So the issue, though, is, you know, you're describing a Washington that is, you know, if you will, wired by money. And, you know, that the public side of this conversation, there isn't a significant political action committee on the public side, right? I mean, I know there's a group of folks who organize themselves on Reddit to create a Political Action Committee, you know, I don't think they have a significant amount of money. I mean, there really isn't much money on the consumer side of this, of these arguments, right?
Right. But here's the good news. The good news is when members of Congress, let's say you're in the House of Representatives, if you even hear from 100 of your constituents, or if you're a senator, if you hear from 500 or 1,000, that will have impact more than money. Because more than money, they need votes. So, yeah, do I like the amount of money in the political process? Absolutely not. But I do think it can be overcome by constituent voices weighing in, and this is where the Internet is so wonderful. I mean, look, I started doing this work 23 years ago. We were still using daisy wheel, typewriters.
Mm-hmm.
And when you had to have a meeting of all your friends, you had to make 20 calls. So the Internet has just lowered the friction and the ability for us not only to do our, coalition work more easily and cheaply, but to reach out to millions of people. So it's just been, frankly, a miracle in that regard. And we can, I'll give you an example. So on PIPA/SOPA, we now have, I think, about 118,000 names of people who have either signed petitions or written letters, and that's just in a couple of days.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we're going to figure out, what congressional districts and what states they're from, and we're going to let their members of Congress and their senators know you've got X hundred number of constituents who think this is a horrible bill. That will have results. When your constituents really show that they care, it becomes increasingly harder for members of Congress to say, well, I don't care. Hollywood wrote me, a $10,000 check. I'm just going to roll you.
And
I just want to make very, very clear that, all these things, I think, need to take place in order to have success. Sometimes we get the criticism, well, you're just an inside Washington group, and, you don't do enough with the grassroots, and we need grassroots. And my feeling is you need it all. You do need somebody who's a constant presence in Washington, D.C., just to let these people know that you're there. And you also need the folks, and again, we do some of that. We're not the best at, we're not as good as, let's say, a Demand Progress. We also reach out to the grassroots, and that's important as well. But you have to do it all. Now, we love to play in the States. And that's where, AT&T in particular and Verizon are just incredibly powerful on Comcast. But again, that's just beyond our resources. So we do the best with what we have. And we do believe that a combination inside-outside game is the way you get things done and can still beat the Washington money. Again, I'd love to see significant campaign finance reform. Larry Lessig was on my board for a number of years, and I love what he's doing. But that's a very, very long haul, and it's not going to happen anytime soon.
Do you think there's anything changing in the public climate now with this whole Occupy Wall Street, we are the 99% versus the 1%? I mean, the banks just, all back down on their plans to increase debit card fees just in the last few days, which is, obviously they're very sensitive to the potential of people withdrawing money from their accounts and moving the money into credit unions. And I think they probably realize that right now, there's a public wave that they have to be responsive to. Is there any sign of that affecting the debate over any of the issues that you work on?
Well, it affects it in a different way. It's not affecting the companies, and here's the reason why. There's no competition, and there's very little competition. When you've got four wireless companies, two of whom are incredibly powerful and two, Sprint and T-Mobile, are incredibly weak, that's, why does AT&T need to listen or Verizon need to listen to anybody?
Mm-hmm.
And I'll give you an example of how they sort of essentially throw sand in the consumer space. Your folks may be aware, but now you start to see these caps on the amount of data you can use over your Internet connection for both wireless Internet and also wireline Internet.
Right.
So what happens is when you hit those caps, you either get charged a huge amount of money for each gigabyte that you use more than that, or you can be disconnected, or your connection can be slowed down.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if there was true competition for Internet access, this would never happen, because these caps have absolutely nothing to do with the fact that some people use a lot of bandwidth at particular times. They're just essentially price gouging.
Right.
I think that's where there's a disconnect with the Occupy Wall Street movement, is that these folks feel no pressure because there's no competition, and this is really where the Federal Communications Commission has failed. They have not put in place the protections for consumers necessary for robust competition.
Well, but isn't there also a deeper problem? It seems to me, you know, I'm thinking about Canada. I was recently there a couple months ago, and, you know, there's a vibrant movement there on these same issues. And Jesse Brown, who is an online writer and activist and runs a great podcast called Search Engine, you know, was starting to push this meme of, you know, let's list all the ways that the Internet sucks in Canada. And they have these caps also. I think they probably have even less, you know, they have a worse situation than we have here. But Americans, I think, and we're guilty of this too, you know, of kind of saying, wow, the Internet's this amazing thing. Look at all these cool things you can do with your phone now or with your iPad. You know, there's the general drumbeat is, well, at least this sector of our economy is dynamic and all these shiny new things, right? And the adulation for Steve Jobs, you know, when he passed away, I mean, it's a signal, right? That we part of us, you know, we really want to believe in this stuff. And what you're describing is a reality that, you know, if people understood how bad the reality was, you know, maybe they'd be a little angrier.
I think people are starting to understand, and I'll tell you how.
Mm-hmm.
Cable television is becoming way too expensive for people to afford. And people
mm-hmm.
are not only dropping their cable subscriptions, they are not signing up at all, particularly younger people. So I think
mm-hmm.
you're starting to kind of see the realization of, you know, of the fact not only that there's very little competition, but that it's just the stuff that is so essential to us is becoming too expensive.
Well,
and I think once people start getting their bills, now that these data caps have just being imposed, once they start getting
mm-hmm.
$300 and $400 overage charges, I think you're going to start
mm-hmm.
to see the outrage. So I think we are kind of on the cusp of people recognizing that all is not well in the communication space, in the Internet space in this country. I think we're still at the very beginning.
What do you think of the recently the FCC just announced a voluntary agreement with the – I mean, this is sort of beyond the original focus of our call, but I might as well ask you. You know, this voluntary agreement with the all the mobile providers to – send people alerts when they're approaching their monthly, you know, whatever their plan allows them, you know, so they can avoid bill shock.
Yeah, I mean, so a couple things are raised by this, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Number one is this agreement was nothing more than what the companies were giving to consumers anyway. So the extent the FCC portrayed this as some great victory to consumers,
mm-hmm.
is nothing more than they're already getting. But
mm-hmm.
it raises a more fundamental issue. The question arises, why didn't the FCC just adopt some rules mandating certain baseline levels of transparency that the wireless companies would have to provide to consumers? Why not?
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Who could disagree with this? Well, let me
mm-hmm.
tell you the answer. The answer is that this FCC, and this first arose in the context of net neutrality, refuses to clarify what its legal authority is to protect consumers from the predatory practices of broadband internet access providers and wireless companies.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you may recall when we were fighting over whether the FCC would adopt network neutrality rules, a decision came out of the Circuit Court of Appeals, the Federal Court of Appeals here in Washington, saying that the FCC did not have the power under the Communications Act or the authority under the Communications Act to regulate the network management practices of broadband internet access providers. At that point, we urged the FCC to classify, to say that broadband internet access is a telecommunications service, like your telephone service.
Right.
And the FCC chairman did not have the courage to do that. So what has happened? What has happened is it is uncertain whether the FCC has the power to protect consumers from the predatory practices of broadband internet access providers and wireless telephone companies.
Mm-hmm.
And so what he's doing is he's trying to avoid having to go to court to determine that every single time. But he can't avoid it. He came out with the net neutrality rules. They have finally gone into effect. They have been appealed right back to that same court in federal court in D.C. And guess what the main question is? Does the FCC have the legal authority to impose these rules? The FCC imposed a requirement that AT&T and Verizon enter into roaming agreements for data. So if T-Mobile or Cricket, you know, a customer wants to, you know, use their data in a place where they don't have service, AT&T and Verizon would have to enter into an agreement to let them to do that. Goes right to court, challenging the FCC's power to engage in those kind of regulations. So this is the overarching theme, and the overarching concern that we have is that because of the chairman's lack of courage to say this is a telephone service of the 21st century and should be regulated as such, we have no idea whether the FCC will really have the power to protect consumers, be it net neutrality, roaming, bill shock, what they call cramming. So there's a whole long list, and it's a very, very tenuous time for consumers right now at the Federal Communications Commission.
Right, right. What is the – and, you know, we're winding down here, so I'm going to ask you a question about the future. I'm going to – let's lift our heads from the grind of the day-to-day.
Right.
Do you see any possibility of, you know, okay, maybe this is intractable, but people have gotten a taste, at least during this window of time here where, the Internet does challenge this other model of communications, you know, sort of artificial scarcity model that you're describing again and again. And, you know, I think there's an awareness that this is a tenuous place that we're in now, and that relying on, you know, the private pipe owners to keep providing the level of freedom that people think they have when they use the Internet, it may be a mistake, and that we need a different backbone entirely. People talking about other solutions for creating peer-to-peer network or mesh networking, or you know the Eben Moglen's idea for the Freedom Box. Do you think there's? I mean, having tasted this, right? And let's assume that the incumbents just don't want to let it, you know, thrive.
Right.
Do you think there's a chance that we can sort of technologically out, you know, sort of the way the Internet supposedly routes around censorship, do you think there's any hope in that solution, or we really are stuck with a situation where it does come down to winning these fights and these regulatory battles?
Look, I always hope, right? But I wouldn't put all my money on it. I think the efforts like Eben Moglen's efforts, some of the mesh networking efforts, some of the community broadband efforts, I think are really important. Although I will say when it comes to having community broadband, when Comcast and Verizon go to their local and state legislators and get laws passed saying you cannot spend taxpayer dollars on a community broadband network, it kind of makes it hard to route around.
Mm-hmm.
So you're always going to have to engage in the day-to-day battle to make sure that they don't legislate competition or workarounds out of existence. This is a lot of what the copyright battles are about, right? I explained this horrible, you know, domain name blocking bill, but the fact of the matter is you could route around all of that, right? All you need is the domain name address. You don't need the domain name, right? The domain address. You don't need the domain name, or the IP address, excuse me, right? So you can get around all those problems.
Right.
Well, what have they done in the House bill? They've made it illegal for people to give people the tools to route around it.
Hmm.
So, you know, the way the big gatekeepers look at things is there's always a way to legislate or regulate. As much as they say they hate regulation, right, there's always a way to regulate our competition into the ground or the workarounds into the ground. So you can't say, well, we'll, you know, have this sort of technological determinism attitude and say, well, we'll just, you know, we'll just innovate around it. It doesn't, mm-hmm. and Silicon Valley, I think, makes that mistake of thinking they just can innovate around, you know, what these companies try to do in the policy sphere. I think you've got to do both.
Do you have friends in Silicon Valley? Are there?
I've got lots of friends in Silicon Valley. In fact, I was just talking to one of them yesterday, a guy named Blake Bakorian, who invented the Slingbox, and which is a miracle that he didn't get sued. It's because he happens to be a really nice guy and made sure that he made nice to the Hollywood company. And he said he, you know, he basically offered himself out to some of the Hollywood studios, to some of the bigwigs there, to try to connect him with some of the innovators in Silicon Valley. And he said he was shocked that some of the studio heads or high people high up in the studios didn't even know how to use a computer.
Mm.
These are the people who are trying to regulate the Internet out of existence to protect mm-hmm. their copyright. And they don't know how to use a computer.
Mm-hmm.
So it is mind-boggling sometimes, you know, what people can cook up in the regulatory/policy arena when they're not even really familiar with the core subject matter of what they're trying to regulate.
Yeah. Well, it's an ongoing fight. I'm going to end on a hopefully more optimistic note, which is I do think that there is a generational shift underway, and so many young people are growing up, you know, taking for granted the level, both the kind of connectivity they have and also the sort of freedom they have. And you know, there is, to my mind, you know, 75 million content share.
Hello?
Conscious of, you know, what's at stake, but as people grow up and begin to sort of you know, enter the public arena, you know, hopefully this will begin to shift too. So, you know, thank you for this report, Gigi, on, you know, life at the front lines in D.C. And, you know, we at PDF will certainly keep an eye on these issues as they absolutely affect people's ability to use these tools to participate more fully in the process and you know, the kinds of things that matter to folks at PDF. So we appreciate your taking the time to talk with us. Once again, you've been listening to the PDF Network PD Plus conference call with Gigi Sohn of Public Knowledge. This will be put up as a podcast and made available online for folks to share. I should mention that 2 weeks from now, we will be having a call with some folks from Reddit who are going to talk about how you build a political community on Reddit.com. So that'll be Eric Martin, who's the general manager, and Eddie Geller, who started a political action committee there devoted to these sorts of issues of Internet freedom. But more, you know, gigantic community site and a place where all kinds of interesting political organizing is happening. So that's in 2 weeks. Until then, we'll see you online. Thanks again to our sponsors at AT&T, and Gigi and Art, thank you for making the time, and stay in touch.
It's our pleasure. Thanks again.